Welcome to B2B Better, a podcast that exists to explore what modern-day B2B marketing looks like. If you work for a company with long sales cycles, has a complex value proposition, and simply pouring money into ads won't see you hit your growth goals, this is the show for you. My name's Jason Bradwell. Let's get into it. Hey, everyone. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Xanthi Vaughan Williams, director and co-founder of Fourth Day Public Relations. PR is one of those topics that all B2B marketers will at some point come into contact with. After all, 80% of decision makers would rather gather their information through articles than through advertisements. And with over two decades of experience under her belt, helping businesses craft cut-through multi-channel communication strategies, Xanthi is well positioned to share exactly what modern day PR looks like. Before we get into it, I would like to thank once again SoPro for sponsoring this episode. They've just published this awesome report, The State of Prospecting 2024, which offers data-backed, practical advice on how to optimize outreach in order to stay ahead of the competition. So I'm going to drop the link to the report in the show notes of this episode. Make sure you check it out. Okay, let's get started. Welcome to B2B Better. Today, I'm very excited to be joined by Xanthi Vaughan Williams. Xanthi, how are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you, Jason. Good to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your story so far and your journey to founding Fourth Day?
Yeah, I actually came into PR relatively late on. I started off my career working in IT, and I worked for the IT department of a magazine publishing company. I worked in their IT department, but I ended up writing for quite a few of their publications as well. And so I combined working in IT with a career as a freelance journalist. Then I went to America for a year, got a job in PR kind of by accident at an art gallery, and came back to the UK and combined PR with technology. And it was, in those days, it was called high tech PR. Got a job with an agency, became a director there, and then just after the 2001 sort of disasters, we set up, and we've always worked in B2B, primarily for the tech industry. And so we've seen quite a lot of changes in the last 20 years.
So we're going to unpack over the next 30 minutes or so how PR has changed, or how you've seen PR change over your career. But I'd be keen to just dig in a little further into Fourth Day. You are a PR agency specializing in B2B. Could you unpack a little bit for me?
Yes, technology B2B is our primary specialism. We've worked quite a lot in some specific areas, such as logistics and supply chain, and merging into retail and manufacturing as well. So I think possibly the industrial side of B2B tech is maybe our sweet spot. But then we also worked with ad tech, martech, a little bit of fintech. So anything in the B2B tech world is we consider within our remit.
How has the perception of PR changed among B2B firms over the last two decades that you've been running Fourth Day?
I think given that we are all about communications, we haven't done an enormously good job in PR of helping anybody understand what PR is. I think it is a difficult thing to grasp. And as I said, it's always been the boundaries between PR and marketing have always been blurred. I don't know if it's changed dramatically, and what we do has always been coming up with the story, helping clients choose their audience, deciding which are the best channels for that, and then if we're dealing with media, creating the stories that we need in order to get people to write about us. I think in that sense, the job hasn't changed, but I think possibly because In this day and age, PR does often involve writing articles for publication. It has become somehow muddled with people writing their own content and publishing it on their own media, effectively owned media. And the fact that you can publish an article and put it on your website is not at all the same thing as having an article published in a magazine. And I think possibly that's caused some confusion in the perception of PR. So I think there is an assumption now that it's very easy to write something and have it published, or to write a news release and that it will automatically be run, which wasn't there maybe a decade or so ago. I'm not quite sure if that's true, but there's certainly, I think there's more of a challenge in PR these days in trying to write the kind of articles that are genuinely informative and will get published and are genuinely of interest to an audience, because everybody's used to being able to just publish something and see how many clicks it gets or send it out, which means also that you're getting instant results, whereas you may put it in a magazine, they may refuse to give you a backlink, particularly if it's a very high DA magazine. And it's, I think there's a slight, where there's an overlap, there's sometimes a little slight confusion as to which is which between PR and marketing.
I think, you know, talking to this kind of trend between kind of the lines blurring between owned media and earned media, I'm keen to get your perspective on the forces you believe are driving this change and have driven this change. Is it the availability of these own channels? Is it a internal investment in better equipped, more highly skilled content teams? Is it an increasing kind of reluctance to rely on the third party channels in order to communicate your brand message? Is it something else? Like, what's driving this decision within B2B organizations to take more control, rightly or wrongly, in owning and distributing their brand message?
I think it's very understandable. Of course you want to control your brand message, and it's easier. It is much, much easier. If you can write your own content, put it out there, you've got complete control over it. But you're missing the key point of PR, which is about building your credibility, building your reputation. And no matter how many times you put out a bit of content saying, I am fantastic and my product is fantastic, you must buy it, it's never going to have the impact as somebody else, a trusted source, whoever that is, saying, hey, this company is really worth looking at and their products are really worth looking at. And that's always been at the heart of PR. And I think that's what's sometimes being overlooked in the focus on owned media. And then also the measurability is a brilliant, both the ability to publish your own content is brilliant. The ability to send out messages to people easily and directly is brilliant. And you can see how they're being received, which is great. So everybody's used to getting very instant results. But if you are influencing other people slowly over time, trying to build a reputation, you don't have any of that. And it takes a lot. It takes much, much longer to achieve. It's much more powerful, but it takes longer. And in B2B, I think it's really particularly important. If you're selling a small product that you can buy, if you're selling a commodity, then obviously the faster you can get information out to people, the better. You can pay influencers. But I think we saw it even with Instagram, when people gradually became aware that influencers were in fact being paid. There was a sort of tipping point there, wasn't there, between people genuinely believing the third party endorsements and then understanding that they're paid. And that division between what's essentially advertising and what's PR still exists quite strongly, I think.
Having worked in PR at the beginning of my career in what I would consider a legacy industry, media broadcast technology, I was always struck by the antiquated nature in which many of the trade journals would run their business. In that, and by that I mean there was some very kind of tactical examples. So for instance, websites just not built for purpose in an age increasingly moving over to mobile, to more strategic. A feeling within the industry at large that many of the articles you would see on these trade media outlets were either pay to play or just simply a, you know, symptom of receiving a press release in the inbox, like anything basically made it up onto these sites. And so I guess the kind of credibility of some of these trade mags was diminished, which prompted a kind of a charge into building out owned media channels. By no means am I suggesting that trade media at large is like this. I'm just observing something I saw in an industry that I spent 10 years working in. And then, you know, indeed a question came up in the organization I worked for, which was, well, is there an opportunity here to, in fact, like almost replace trade media, you know, in a way, right? Like we can be the ones providing a perspective on the developments of the industry, and as such build our credibility through that means. And I guess my question here is this something that you've also observed across other verticals and sectors that you work in? Yeah, can you get your perspective on that?
And I think your point, there's a couple of points in there on the trade media has always had maybe a slightly uneasy balance between where advertising ends and where editorial begins. 20 years ago, there were five times as many trade magazines, and they varied. They varied from the ones who basically is pay to play, and they used to ask for a thing called a colour separation charge, which dated back to way before my time, which was something to do with what you charge for printing an ad or something, which basically meant just a little fee. But then at the other end of the scale, there's the Computer Weeklies who are breaking the news of the post office scandal and were way ahead of the Nationals on that. And there are still some very good trade media who are doing sterling work and independent editorial work. Mostly they're pretty strapped for cash. So yeah, advertising matters. But any magazine that's actually running just puff pieces is obviously not worth its salt. But I don't think that is definitely not true of all the trade media. And I don't think some of them would thank you for that particular writer. Then on the other hand, what you're saying about the brands taking over the role, in theory, that could happen. But how many neutral, genuine pieces of content do you see from brands? There's some insight, and this is where we try and help the brands, is to write an article about the industry that is not simply saying, weirdly, the solution to this problem is whatever we offer. Because that does tend to be, inevitably, if I'm writing about marketing, weirdly, PR does tend to make it in there. So I think I would question the ability of brands to produce something that's genuinely neutral, independent, and useful. But you can share insights on your particular area of expertise, but usually, and I think in a wider context, which is what we try and help people to do. And the publishing of papers is something that we do a lot with clients, which again is probably one of the things you're referring to. So we'll write a report, we'd interview not just our client, we'd interview several other people, get some industry, external industry experts, maybe even a competitor, but not usually, and produce a piece of content like that can be wonderful because you've got your own content, then you've got the spin outs that come with it, you can have an event, similar to the report that SoPro have just written, which is interesting, valuable to the industry. And there will be an event where people can find out more about it. It's interesting, though, that the trade media titles are still going, isn't it? That people do still want to be. People are still paying for ads in them. And sometimes we have seen clients pay phenomenal amounts of money to be associated with a title that has very high prestige, but is absolutely the wrong target for their audience. And not understanding the way the commercial arms of these organizations sometimes work, that actually if you do a deal with one of these big publications, they won't run your story in their publication, and nor will anybody else because it's branded by them. But people are still drawn to media, I think, and they still do have power.
We're not here today to talk about the death of trade media, despite how the first 10 minutes of this interview have gone. So we are here to talk about the role of trade media as part of a kind of larger multi-channel message. And you referred to SoPro earlier, having recently released their State of Prospecting report for 2024. One of the key themes, findings from that report, I believe, is the value in developing a kind of multi-channel program when attempting to prospect. Mm. And so I'm keen to get your thoughts on, when you have all of these different channels to choose from, earned media, owned platforms, how can you go about tailoring a message across those different channels to ensure a kind of cohesive and personalized experience for prospects?
Yeah, I think it's very much the message that SoPro have come up with, that it's got to be multi-channel and there is no one channel that you should be relying on. And I think that's always been the case as well. I'm sorry to keep sounding like it hasn't changed. It's always been this, but you need to start by, who are you trying to reach? What do you want them to think? deciding what the messages are going to be for those people, because it may say sometimes it's I wasn't particularly saying that what we do in B2B tech PR is target the trade media, because it absolutely isn't. It's what is the audience, how are you going to reach the audience you want to reach? Sometimes we're based in London and Manchester in the UK, and sometimes we have had tech clients who just want to be known in the Northwest, in which case it's regional media. And that's something that's very strong, actually, in the Northwest Manchester area. There are a lot of little good, strong business titles which really focus on that area. And if you're an entrepreneur looking for local funding, then being seen in those magazines really matters to you. So it's horses for courses. If actually PR may not be part of the mix at all, depending on who you're trying to reach, it may be better to just do an email campaign and an event, perhaps. But where PR adds the value is where you need to be taken seriously. Maybe you're a small company launching in a market that everyone else is bigger than you. You need to seem larger than your size. You need to have clout. If you're looking for investment, you need your CEO to be taken seriously, because the investors will look up, they'll Google your CEO and your board, or they'll Google all your people. And if you're seen, if when you're found online, you are being quoted talking about your subject, that will be very powerful. For those people, you just need to be found commenting online. Every situation is different. We had an example recently. One of our clients works in the transportation industry, providing safety technology for lorries. We've been working with them across Europe. And one of the challenges is that they produce cameras, which are inside cabs. One of the issues for them is that privacy in quite a few European countries is very serious, taken very seriously, correctly. But cameras are in fact banned in some places. And there's a trade-off between safety and privacy of drivers. So for them, because the policy is very important, one thing we did for them was we found a conference at which a lot of policymakers were speaking. So this is where PR slipped almost into public affairs, if you like. But we managed to get them, we submitted them for a speaking slot. We wrote a paper for them, helped them with their presentation. And in that case, we got them in front of a load of policymakers. So there is no one channel. And ideally, you'll be doing several at a time. It's just spreading your budget in the right places.
So I despise one-size-fits-all strategies. As you've rightly pointed out there, it doesn't exist. We can, adopt common principles that will work across companies and industries and channels. But in terms of playbooks, they rarely exist. But with that being said, the audience of B2B Better predominantly are working in SMBs, limited resources when it comes to marketing and comms. In that type of situation, are there any places to start? Blank slate. We're a new business. We have to get our name out there a little bit. What should we be looking to do? Can you share any insight on that?
I think it depends on your sector, but usually, certainly with most of the tech companies we're working with, they are selling to a particular sector. So they may be technology, but technology media won't be where they're trying to be. They might be wanting to be in finance publications, may want to be in marketing publications. It depends. So if you've got a decent base of trade media, you can start using those by getting your name into those via comment, opinion, what have you got to say. Try to think what your message is that's going to get to them. So going back to what I was saying earlier, start with the messaging, try and decide what it is you're going to say. From there, we try and create some stories. I think if I was, obviously it depends on if they may have a marvelous database, but I think that often trying to get face-to-face, so going to the right events, getting a speaking opportunity at the right event perhaps, and then getting some media behind it so that they're being seen by the right people, is a great place to start. Not massively expensive in terms of spending on paid ops. I think speaking opportunities are something that are good in B2B, because you just get face-to-face with the right people. Having a stand at an exhibition, I tend to think less, but That's a personal view, and it depends on the exhibition. And then, but they're backing that up with media because you've got to have those different touch points, haven't you? And then if you can do some really personalized direct mail to your prospects, then great. And that this is where a company like SoPro, I believe, comes in. But if I was advising on a PR point of view, I think for a small company, building up the profile of your founder is often a good place to start, because you've got to think of the angles that are going to interest. It's very hard to do this as a general because it does vary so much. But if you're a small company, it depends whether if you're just trying to sell more stuff and build up your credibility, then I think just LinkedIn campaigns can be quite powerful. But I think focusing on a founder is usually quite a good place to start, or a CEO, if not a founder.
Research suggests that your employee base is going to be connected to 10 times as many people as your brand is at any point. It's all relative. So if you have 10,000 followers on social media, you'll have 10 times as many people available to you through your employee network. And certainly when you look at your executive team and your founders, as you say, a really clear place to start. I want to dig a little bit into relationships with the media, because as we both know, it's often not enough just to simply get the email address of a journalist, ping them a press release, and then see that story published online. The most successful PR campaigns are ones that are, built with long-standing relationships with journalists and editorial staff developed over time. And now we have more channels than ever to build those connections, those one-to-one connections with journalists. So I'm keen to dig a little bit into that with you in regards to the role of digital and social media and how they can be used as an aid in relationship building with journalists.
Yes, I think social media comes into the world of PR in a number of different ways. The interesting thing about building relationships with media is that I think it's no longer a question of getting to the stage where the editor of the Telegraph takes you out for a port or anything. I think it's much more you start building momentum because the trade media are looking in other trade media and national media to see who's being written about. And it's quite an interesting momentum happens. So that once you've started appearing, we had a client we started who'd done none at all just about a year ago, had done no PR at all before that. And we started gradually building up momentum. And what was interesting with them is it happened very quickly. As soon as we'd got them written about in a few of the publications in their area, they started getting inbound inquiries from other ones. And then gradually we focused on their CEO very much and building up his profile. And before too long, people started asking his opinion. So it wasn't so much that they were building up individual relationships with journalists that they have now, but just that seeing the name out is one of the things that managed to stimulate journalists' interest. I think as in PR, one of our jobs is to try and make journalists' lives easier. And as you'll have remember from your days, what they really don't like is you just pestering them to death with a story that's not relevant to them. So there's still a lot of what we do is actually just desperately trying to think of the story that's really going to work for them and their reader. So you've got this intersection of what you want to say, and then why is it interesting to the journalist reader? And then if there's an extra reason why the journalists themselves should be interested, you've got to get that in there as well. And if you can get those three things together, then you've got that story. And that's a story that will not only get past the first gatekeeper, which is the journalist, but will then hit the end readers as well. And in terms of the channels, are you talking about social media? And does that make it easier? It's just another channel, really, as far as reaching journalists is concerned. You can direct message them if they ever want to. Charles Arthur at the Telegraph used to insist on only being contacted by Twitter when Twitter first came out. But it helps if you're not getting an answer to an email and you're not getting an answer to a phone call, then you can try a direct message. And if you happen to be better mates with one journalist, it's easier than another. But really, it all boils down to the story that you're offering them and whether it's going to work for them. Especially with freelancers, they want stories they can pitch to their editors. The art of PR is, no, is finding the story that they can sell on. And that's particularly true when it gets to the nationals, getting into the Sun, the Mail, and onto the BBC or the Telegraph or wherever. You need the story that's going to make the journalist's life easy. They can pitch it to their editor and they'll get brownie points. They'll get a nice story. They'll get a byline. But you've got to do it. You've got to know what you're doing when you pitch to them. So just the other thing on social media, though, which I don't think we've touched on so far, is how important that is when it comes to sharing coverage. Because getting press coverage in the trade media alone, in some cases, yes, there may not be that many people who are rushing to read that particular magazine, but you sharing it online, sharing it on your LinkedIn, all, as you mentioned, all the employees sharing it, then you've got real reach. And just anecdotally, I've been quoted in a few articles recently, nothing particularly major, but people notice that you wouldn't think notice. Somebody stopped me in the supermarket and said, oh, I saw you quoted in a magazine the other day. I had no idea anyone read it or anything. So sharing it really does work. And that third-party credibility, again, you were saying you were casting doubts on the credibility of the trade media. But people being, you can't underestimate the power of being quoted in a magazine, even the trade ones.
I want to unpick the idea of a story a little bit with you, because I think that people listening to this episode, you know, they'll probably be nodding their heads in agreement and saying, yes, absolutely, we need a great story to go and tell the media if we want to be published. But what is a good story? And is a good story...
God, the people have written books on this subject, as I'm sure, Jason. But there are various simple tests you can do. We have one, actually, just for ourselves, because that question of can you ever see objectively yourself, the answer is it's really difficult. But when we're sharing, if we're going to share a story on LinkedIn, for example, because LinkedIn is full of so many people saying, I'm so proud of this, or read this, very interesting, when it isn't. We have a little test that we share it on our Slack channel in the company, first of all. If it falls dead, we don't put it on. We don't put it onto LinkedIn or anything like that. But if people go, oh, funny you should say that, and start talking about it, go, yep, okay, that's a good one. Because it's very hard to tell. Obviously, that's just with little social media comments. This is not, we're not talking about big strategy stories for the clients. But it's, why would anyone care is the usual big question. And if you're, and if you're aiming for a particular magazine, so if you want to be on the 10 o'clock news, okay, why would anyone want to watch that on the 10 o'clock news? What would they, imagine yourself watching the 10 o'clock news? And what article would it follow on from? And sometimes trying to talk, if when you have a slightly unrealistic expectation from a client, it can be helpful to just press them on it a little bit. When they're saying, I think this would be a great article in The Economist. You can say, great, which sort of section do you think it would go in? And what can you see a similar article that you're thinking of? And then usually the truth of whether it's a good fit or not will come through from that. Because it's mean to dash people's hopes by just saying, don't be ridiculous. We'll get a little overcarried away ourselves as well. When we first set up Fourth Day, we won our first big client and we were so excited. We thought we should do a news release. And somebody asked us why, and said, why do you think that would be news? And we realized it wasn't. It was horrible.
As we look at rounding out this episode, where can people learn more about you and Fourth Day and come to you for an objective opinion on what makes for a good story?
Oh, they could visit our website, which is www.fourthday.co.uk, or just Google Fourth Day. Our name comes from the fourth day of Christmas. We were set up by four women, and we thought it was funny because we were four calling birds, which is now no longer quite such a shareable story.
We will drop the links to your website and to your LinkedIn as well in the show notes of this episode. But otherwise, Xanthi, thank you very much for coming on to Be Better today.
Thank you very much, Jason.
So that was a great interview from Xanthi at Fourth Day. I've now welcomed on my friend here, Kit Smith, who is the content and SEO manager from SoPro. And I've invited him on because they've just published, as I mentioned at the top of this episode, this amazing state of prospecting report for 2024. It's one of the biggest and most in-depth looks at the tactics and trends that are shaping go-to-market prospecting across B2B. And they cover in detail in this report this idea of multi-channel and how to be effective in communicating to your prospective customers across multiple channels. So I thought that he'd be able to offer an interesting response and perspective to some of the themes and trends that Xanthi shared during the interview in relation to the findings that they had in the report.
A large part of the conversation with Xanthi Kit focused on this idea of multi-channel marketing. So could you share some actionable tips on how to run an effective multi-channel program?
Yeah, I think you both talked about multi-channel marketing in terms of that wider kind of across paid and owned and earned. And obviously getting that all working together like a nicely well-oiled machine and them all complementing each other is like the long-term goal. But I think when you're, particularly when you're a smaller business, it can be difficult to know what to focus on. And different elements within that have a kind of more direct commercial return. So I would say that if you find the kind of one or two that you can, that you know work for you and have that immediate impact and you can see ROI, you can quite work on those. Don't spread yourself too thin. Really concentrate on those and then maximize them. But then you do also need to take the time to build up that longer term stuff that doesn't have a kind of immediate return. And that's going to be like obviously useful for the longer term, for your sort of like the impact that it has in the longer term. But then within, so that sort of multi-channel, I think across those kind of owned and earned and paid, but then you've also got, we in the SoPro report, we talk about multi-channel in terms of prospecting and how that same approach has come to outbound marketing. You know, in the past, I think outbound was a very just pick up the phone, send an email, job done. But it's increased in its sophistication. So a long time ago, it's one to many, low quality, inefficient, sometimes spammy. It moved on to a much more targeted and relevant and personalized approach. But we're seeing it evolve further into a kind of similar to inbound methods, this cross-channel storytelling. And I think if you're doing outbound on your own as small scale, you again, if you find that one channel that works for you, so generally it'll be email, and then you can start layering other touch points on top of that, adding LinkedIn messages to the people that you've had a reply to on email or like their stuff or whatever it is. But you can keep layering. Obviously, the only problem is that as you grow and you scale those campaigns and you add in more and more channels, the workload of that just exponentially goes up. But it's definitely something that you can do early on to just keep layering and see what works.
It's really interesting because I've always looked at prospecting and like running an outbound program as much a marketing activity as it is a sales activity, because I've been the recipient of, as you have and as we all have, like really shitty sales emails. And sometimes these are due to people now using AI to create their sales prospecting content. Other times I think it's just salespeople who just don't know like how to actually build effective prospecting sequences. What is the right cadence to be running with? What should the content within that email sequence look like? So it's more than just a, hey, can we grab a quick coffee type deal? And certainly in my previous roles as a marketer, trying to enable a sales team to be more effective because we're selling into enterprise and marketing in an enterprise environment for me isn't a sales enablement activity. It's about how do we adopt some of these kind of like marketing best practices that we're applying on like social media and our blog and our own marketing email campaigns and like taking that down to that one-to-one, one-to-few outbound prospecting program. Like how do we tell an effective story? How do we articulate like thought leadership? How do we provide value and be comfortable with that value, maybe not necessarily generating an immediate return? Hey, I want to buy something from you. So I think that's what you're saying, right? It's like the evolution of multi-channel marketing, thinking about outbound as part of that multi-channel program and just trying to think in a more deeper and sophisticated way around what does effective outbound actually look like for the modern day B2B buyer.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like you say, you've got to bring in those kind of lessons from other channels, but also be aware that different channels are different, right? And can't sell everything about your business in a quick LinkedIn message or an email. No one wants to read that.
So I think a lot of B2B brands understand the need to invest in building out their own channels, like a blog or like a social media program, employee advocacy, whatever it is. But they fail to really develop a meaningful strategy that's grounded in real thought leadership. And I think this is getting worse with the rise of tools like ChatGPT and other like AI content generation machines, which is fueling this commodity content fire. So could you share any examples of companies that you've seen deliver real world commercial impact as a result of a high quality, high value owned media campaign?
Yeah, there's some funny ChatGPT, like it can write, and you can argue whether it can write as well as a content writer, but it can write. It's not great at kind of the thinking and the strategy and the thought leadership, like you say, because it's basically Google in a different format. It's just like an average of everything that already exists out there. So it's not going to give you some kind of interesting, new, fresh insight that's relevant, or not relevant, but that's not going to be really new and interesting and insightful to your audience. And yeah, so in terms of an example, forgive going close to home, but the State of Prospecting report, and it's not revealing any kind of secrets to say that's a big part of our like owned kind of marketing campaign at the moment. But yeah, that started because we sit on this mountain of data and we continually analyze all of it anyway internally for what we do. And we were like, there's a lot of interesting stuff in here that could be like useful for our audience. And we are like experts. I think it might sometimes can take you a while to appreciate that you are, but that you've got something to say. And it was written, for the main part, I wrote it, and I wrote it to be genuinely interesting and valuable. And I hope you'd agree it's not promotional material for SoPro. It's just meant to be like, this is an analysis of where we see outbound prospecting at the moment. But of course, like someone downloads it and they find it insightful and they become familiar with us as kind of experts in the field. And so that positions us in their mind. But then off the back of that, going back to that multi-channel thing, like they'll get nurture emails from us. They'll, if they've downloaded it, they're probably in our target audience. So then they're probably in our prospecting campaigns. So then we're going to reach out to them as well. And then you start to see all of that kind of journey play out across kind of multiple channels that might have just started with that, or it's just helped as part of that. So like I said, different channels, different formats. This is a long form one that shows the expertise. An email is a short one that just says, hey, do you want to chat?
How can marketers listening to this episode of B2B Better think more strategically around the role of prospecting in building a trustworthy and credible brand?
I think in conversation with Zanthi, like you absolutely need to get your name out there and you need to build your brand. But obviously that can take time. Like in the meantime, you need new business opportunities and you need a regular supply of them over a sustained period. Like you can't, I've heard it said before, is you can't run out of runway. You need to keep going for long enough to be able to take off. And I think prospecting is great for that, in that sort of immediate return. But it also, obviously, it drives awareness in your kind of target audience. As part of the beauty is you've got this list of, exactly the people you want to contact. You contact them across multiple channels, but then it also draws eyes to like your own channels. Obviously, if people get an email and they're interested in what you've got to say, even if they don't do anything off the back of it, they're going to check you out, either you personally as the person sending the email or your company or both. So then, we can see that. We track activity in our own campaigns. You can see how often that happens. So yeah, while PR and that kind of and other activity you do is like building your credibility and establishing your brand, as that kind of kicks in, that's only going to make your prospecting improve. But actually, multi-channel prospecting aims to echo that process in a sense of, okay, we're sending emails, they're connecting on social, I'm seeing their content in other ways. It helps to reinforce like multiple touch points, increase brand recall. Yeah, I think it's a similar thing. It just maybe is a different way of getting there.
Kid Smith, thank you very much.
And that's it for this episode of B2B Better. Thank you so much for giving me your time this week. If you are a repeat listener, thanks for coming back. If you did take any value out of this interview, please make sure you subscribe, rate, and review in your podcast platform of choice. It really makes a huge difference for an emerging creator like myself. Ugh, that sounded so bad, emerging creator. But I'm going to stick with it because we're here. If you want to learn more about the services at B2B Better, you can visit my website, www.b2b-better.com. A huge thanks to my guest this week. See you all next week.